This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, listeners of the Mad Scientist Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Cogswell, joined as always by my co-host, Marie Mayhew. And this week, joined by special guest, Michael Isikoff, investigative journalist, host of podcasts, writer, just all around fascinating guy. Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I thought he was punking me when he told me that. When he texted me and he says, we have him for the show, I was like, right, I'm sure we do.
Yeah, Marie.
I still have my doubts.
And you do.
Because here I am. And it's not a conspiracy.
So, yeah, pretty.
That I know of.
Well, let's not jump to any conclusions on that score.
True.
Right. That's the beauty of those conspiracy theories, right? They just never have an end. You just always say, well, what if?
Well, you know, we have to investigate each and every one.
Absolutely. So actually,
that's what we do at Conspiracy Land.
Well, that I think is a great way to start off, really, is what. So, you know, when a couple of years ago, when, you know, my mom or my mother-in-law or my wife would see the kind of books I have on my bookshelf, you know, they would always kind of laugh and say, well, why are you even interested in all of this stuff that is so out there, right? Like, why do you care if people believe in ghosts or in Bigfoot or in any of these other sorts of wide-ranging things? And the answer I always gave was that these are real people, and they vote, and they live. They're our neighbors. They are in the world around us. And so understanding why they are interested in these sort of non-scientific or in some cases even seemingly irrational topics is really, I thought, really important. And I don't think there's ever been a period in human history where that has become more apparent that that is important. But I guess I'm wondering what got you interested in these topics in the first place, or what made you want to do a show like Conspiracy Land?
Well, I have always been fascinated by conspiracy theories, not because I believe in them. You know, most of the ones that I've investigated and spent time as a journalist looking at don't pan out, don't hold up under scrutiny. But I do think that they're a sort of fascinating window into our political culture, into how various people on the political spectrum view their adversaries, how they view the world, and it's clear that they get a great deal of traction on both sides of the political fence. You know, currently we associate conspiracy theories with Trump world, with QAnon, with the right-wing fringe. But, you know, this cuts across political lines. We just did my other podcast is Skullduggery, and we just did a show because it was the 58th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination just a couple weeks ago. And people don't really remember, but it was the Kennedy assassination and the conspiracy theories about it that really introduced the phrase conspiracy theory into the political dialogue. Not that that was the first time conspiracy theory had popped up in American politics, and they've been with us since the dawn of the Republic, certainly in the 19th century, the Know-Nothing Party papal plots, you know, into the 20th century, Father Coughlin, you know, getting to Joe McCarthy. You know, conspiracy theories have been with us as a constant, but where they became a you know, a force in our democratic dialogue. It was really the Kennedy assassination. And it starts, you know, after the Warren Commission releases its report in 1964. There was a study that showed that was like the first time the phrase conspiracy theory started appearing in the New York Times, I think five times in 1964. Hmm. And those conspiracy theories were largely from the left. That the Warren Commission was a cover-up for the CIA, the FBI. They were all involved in some way. Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy, as he claimed to be when he was arrested, and he was really being used as part of some CIA operation that was anti-Castro, even though he was a Marxist actually had, defected to the Soviet Union and was trying to re-defect in the last few weeks or months of his life. So I think that's just important context. And needless to say, the conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination got enormous traction among, by and large, people on the left, right through to the Oliver Stone movie, JFK, which glorified this nutball Garrison, the prosecutor in New Orleans, who concocted a completely phony case to blame the Kennedy assassination on the CIA. So that was, that was kind of my introduction, because this is when I grew up. This is when I became politically conscious. And I was, among the many who obsessed about the Kennedy assassination. I remember going down to Dallas and, trolling on going to the Texas School Book Depository and spending time on the grassy knoll.
Oh, wow.
Look. This comes to, within a few years of the Kennedy assassination and all the talk about it, there is, the Vietnam War, there's Watergate, there's in the 70s, the Church Committee, which seemed to validate the ideas that there was all sorts of nefarious activities that our intelligence and law enforcement services were engaged in, which really gave a lot of legs to conspiracy theories. And again, that was largely on the left, not exclusively, because, as I said before, I mentioned Joe McCarthy. Certainly, I should mention the John Birch Society on the right, Robert Welch, the candy manufacturer who started it, talked about how Dwight Eisenhower was a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. Right. So there was plenty of kookiness on both sides. But I think it is interesting that in more recent years, it is the right that seems to have adopted, or elements of the right that have adopted conspiracy theories as sort of central to their worldview.
Well, I think what's, at least from, one thing we touch on in the show really quite often, I almost feel like a broken record sometimes when we point this out on episodes, but, looking back at sort of conspiracy theory, and I think more broadly even pseudoscience or sort of disbelief in expertise or disbelief in, experts coming out and giving information to the public. Like you said, I think if we kind of were to list the most prominent, at least in people's minds, conspiracy theories over the last, say, 100 years, it does appear that there tend to be more on the left side, let's say, of the political spectrum pre kind of Trumpism. But actually part of me wonders if that isn't due to the more conspiratorial aspects of the right wing almost kind of nestling snugly into religious systems. So, I'm looking right now at my bookshelf at a copy of Michelle Remembers, right? One of a kind of a foundational book on the Satanic Panic, which I think really led directly into QAnon. It's the same kind of conspiracies. They're the same kind of ideas. Just remove Satanists for deep state, actors. right? But it's the same general ideas.
They always have the same tropes.
Right. The stories never change. Just kind of the window dressing does. Right. But so I wonder actually if in the modern, sometimes I wonder, I guess, if it isn't sort of a push and pull where in periods where there are more conservatives control generally, that conspiracy theories on the left then will emerge and vice versa.
Well, yeah, I am curious as to what sort of galvanizes that conspiracy theories or the belief in the conspiracy theories, right? Like you right. pointed out.
So look, a couple things, you know, come to mind. You know, one is that when you have segments of the electorate of society that are disaffected, that are distrustful of authority, that don't believe what the experts say, don't believe the media and what the media says, because the media is always plays a role on in conspiracy theories, left or right. They're either, you know, for the left, it's corporate media covering up you know, wrongdoing by the establishment. If it's the right, it's, you know, the liberal biased media that is covering up news that is awkward for, you know, the Democratic Party establishment. I think you get that on both sides. But so that's a constant. And, you know, there are always sort of grains of truth in some of these critiques. I mean, look, I mentioned the church committee before. Mm-hmm. That really did reveal some pretty scary tactics that were being used during the height of the Cold War by the CIA and the FBI, COINTELPRO, the sort of, you know, secret operation authorized by J. Edgar Hoover to discredit civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King. On the CIA's part, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, the mad scientist who was experimenting by injecting, LSD in unwitting participants.
The MK Ultra. Yeah. Oh, and Elimination by Illumination, the plot on Castro.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, assassinations, attempted assassinations, not just of Castro, but by Lumumba in Congo. And, there were others that and not to mention the sort of coups that the United States government inspired in Iran and Guatemala engineered, really. So all that, you know, if you're on the left, you have good reason to distrust what the FBI, what the CIA has to say, what the national security establishment has to say. And just moving forward, it's not just height of the Cold War. I did a book a number of years ago with my co-author David Korn, Hubris, about the run-up to the Iraq War and all the untruths that were stated, not just from the Bush White House, but from the CIA and the intelligence community about what was known about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda. Much of the case, if not almost, you know, the guts of the case were completely inflated and in many cases just completely false, right? So there was good reason to be distrustful of much of what the national security establishment has had to say over the years. And on the right, you know, plenty of evidence, I think, that they could rightfully point to at bias by the media that tended to be much tougher on Republican wrongdoing than Democratic wrongdoing. Not exclusively, of course, but, you know, one can understand how people on the right may have viewed, I certainly do, may have viewed some of the coverage. And I think this reached its peak under Donald Trump's presidency, where you have this bifurcated media Fox News acting as, you know, the propaganda arm of the Trump White House for much of the time, but CNN becoming the anti-Fox and MSNBC already had become the anti-Fox, right? So their coverage of the Trump presidency was just as one-sided as Fox News's was on the other side. Now, I happen to think, you know, Trump did a lot of really awful things as president and violated sort of fundamental norms of our democracy. And he's continuing to do it as we speak.
Yes.
You know, but that said, you know, a big chunk of the country voted for this guy twice now, more than 70 million Americans just last month. And when you, you know, sort of lose sort of, you know, standard forms of journalistic professionalism and become much more loose about being opinionated, people who don't share your opinions will rightfully conclude that you're biased and you're not, a fair umpire calling balls and strikes. You've got skin in the game. So I understand that. Now, what's made it a lot worse and why we're in this golden age of conspiracy theories now is because of social media. And, you know, we had the breakups of the big media networks. They haven't broken up, but they've, you know, lost their power because we have so many other sources of news. But you add on top of that social media, Twitter, Facebook, in which everybody, you know, creates their own silo, in which they only see news that reinforces their prejudices, and they only read that which strokes their, you know, paranoia, and conspiracy theories become a lot battier, crazier, and, you know, QAnon being the primary example.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask, because it seems like you have both sides having sort of this conspiratorial mindset for certain things, but then it takes almost a galvanizing moment to really have something take off, right? Because there's a lot of conspiracy theories that gain traction for a short amount of time and then just peter away and don't really, you know, you don't hear about them in that iteration too often again. But all of a sudden, 2016 election, Facebook, everything that's going on with Twitter, and then this sort of advent of this new, at least a more prevalent group of conspiratorial thinkers come out of seemingly the woodwork, although they've been probably in gestation for a pretty long period of time. Do you think? Is QAnon something that is new, or is it just a reinterpretation of something that had been going on?
Well, I mean, it clearly has roots in, you know, various conspiracy theories that predate QAnon per se, child sex trafficking. We all remember Pizzagate from the 2016 election. That really hits home for me because Comet Pizza is, about 5 to 10 minutes from my house. We would go there all the time on Sunday afternoons. My son's little league team would, you know, congregate at the Comet Pizza after its games. And, you know, luckily we did not have a game that Sunday that the guy from North Carolina drove up with the assault rifle looking for the basement where children were supposedly being sexually abused and ended up, you know, firing a couple of shots.
That's so crazy. And just like the vilification of a physical location. Like pizza, like you're taking
and real
your kid
people
there
work
to,
there,
yeah.
And you know, yeah. You know. But anyway, but that kind of, you know, predated QAnon, but it very much merged into the sort of QAnon worldview, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, that there are a bunch of Democratic child sex traffickers and pedophiles who are, you know, running the country and, you know, ensconced inside the deep state. And anyway, look, I mean, QAnon is really batty stuff. I mean, it's, you know, crazy, really. Mm-hmm. But because of social media, it can get the kind of traction it's getting. And then let's not forget, you know, when once it reaches a certain point, then it gets encouragement from people like El Presidente, Donald Trump, mm-hmm. who refused to disassociate himself from QAnon.
Do you think that that is because he actually believes in it to a certain extent, or that he can see sort of the financial gain?
I mean, look, he's the curator in chief, and he believes all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories, and he always has. But let's just remember, he first got prominence as a potential presidential candidate by spouting the birtherism nonsense, right?
Yes.
And gave that credence. And even when he was running for president in 2016, you know, I remember right after he got the nomination at the Republican convention in Cleveland, the very first thing he did the next day after he gave his acceptance speech was he went on a rant about Ted Cruz's father and the Kennedy assassination. Right?
Yes.
I mean, so this is the way the guy thinks, right? And, you know, does he really believe it? Who knows what he really believes? But he says that which, you know, makes him feel better and strokes his own ego. And, you know, that's come into full flower now with his claim that he won this year's election in a landslide when, in fact, he lost quite decisively.
I wonder, going off that same sort of line of thinking, though, I do wonder what effect that bad faith sort of political theater has had on the growth of these conspiracies. We see this a lot with less, let's say, impactful or less down to earth, I suppose, conspiracies. Not that QAnon is in any way down to earth, but let's take, for example, the conspiracy theory of, you know, widespread election fraud and voter fraud. That, you know, you can turn on even, say, CNN or MSNBC, less MSNBC, but you can turn on CNN and watch as kind of mouthpieces for the Republican Party and the president and mouthpieces for, you know, the opposition and the Democrats make arguments that, you know, as you're watching, you're thinking to yourself, there's no way I know these people don't believe this. Right. There's just simply no way that they actually believe.
Well, look at can I just, like, you know, we did. I have this Conspiracy Land podcast. Yeah. Right. And, you know, the first year last year we did Seth Rich, which is really interesting because I don't know if you noticed, but just, you know, the parents had sued Fox News, which promoted the conspiracy theory about Seth Rich having been the real source of the DNC emails to WikiLeaks. And, you know, the horrific toll that took on the parents, the family, the friends of Seth Rich. And they just won a settlement from Fox News. The terms are undisclosed, but I reported that there was a seven-figure payout from Fox to the parents of Seth Rich for what they for promoting that bogus story that really has quite a sort of fascinating pedigree from, you know, Russian disinformation, Russian trolls to, you know, American alt-right figures to Roger Stone to Steve Bannon, you know, and ultimately to Fox News. But the one we did this year was Trump's crazed Twitter rant about Joe Scarborough having murdered a congressional staffer of his 19 years ago.
Right.
And we dug into that story. It's a three-part podcast. It's really quite fascinating. And it was all garbage. I mean, it was all garbage that actually began on the left, because at the time Scarborough was a Republican congressman, and this grew up out of the you know, it was this, it's, it began in the same summer as the Chandra Levy Gary Condit Fuhrer in Washington, Gary Condit having been a Democratic congressman who was having an affair with an intern, Chandra Levy, who then is found dead in Rock Creek Park. You know, and the conspiracy theories there were that Condit was somehow responsible for her death. He wasn't. He was having an affair, but right, he wasn't responsible for her death. But because of the all the media furor that got, people on the left started to go after Scarborough, saying, well, what about the dead young woman who worked on his staff in Florida? Why isn't the media covering that? And that got, you know, the Daily Kos guy, he's, we do an interview with him in Conspiracy Land. He was promoting that, right? You know, Marcos Melitzis. And then, of course, it gets adopted. It migrates its way to the political right. It gets adopted by Trump, who goes on these rants about, you know, Scarborough was having an affair with this woman and the case needs to be, you know, cold case, reopen. You know, there were like 10 or 11 tweets that Trump did just this year in May after about Scarborough and why isn't Scarborough being investigated for the death of this woman. And then of course it gets picked up by QAnon, and the QAnon crazies, you know, jump on it and embellish it. And, you know, before, by the end of the day, this poor woman, Lori Klausutis, who did pass away in a horrible freak medical accident that happened to her while she was working for Scarborough, was somehow, you know, reviewing, you know, had access to documents about CIA death squads and, you know, all sorts of nefarious activities. Before you knew it, it was like, you know, 9/11 and was.
Right.
Yeah. Her out there in her remote location. You know, was she? Yeah.
It's crazy.
So ridiculous.
It was all crazy. Anyway, we did a 3-part series on this, just dissecting it and ending with, you know, what we call the Twitter dodge, because Twitter allowed this crap to, right, you know, go up on its platform and would not stop, wouldn't take down Trump's tweets, even though there was nothing to them. Now, obviously, they've gotten a lot better, you know, more recently. But, you know, this was only, this was 2020. This was this year.
But that's what I wonder, though, is, sorry, Bree.
Oh, God.
But that's kind of what I guess what I'm wondering is, so we talk about, you know, Twitter's getting better at this and everything else, but there, it seems to me like the ability to call, like you said, crap, right? To be able to say, like, this is ridiculous. There's no way this is true. That goes out the window when you have people in, you know, on these news shows, in interviews and everything else, making cases that they would never make in good faith, right? Like the, you know, the, like almost just playing devil's advocate or just doing this political theater to say, okay, yeah, you know, Trump lost this election, but still you have like Rick Santorum or people on CNN arguing Trump's points, and it's like you don't believe this. I know you don't. So that seems to me to be a significant problem. This sort of it's not that facts, you know, people seem to think today, or it appears to me at least, that facts are political capital, and so it doesn't really matter if something is true or not or abhorrent or not. What matters is that it can be used to score political points. That seems like something that is bigger than Twitter.
Scarborough instance, it was very simple. I mean, you know, Scarborough had become a critic of Trump.
Right.
Once he and Nika were once, you know, kind of friendly with Trump. They had him on the show. They even went down and saw him at Mar-a-Lago just before the inauguration in 2017. They were there New Year's Eve. They were trying to score an interview with him, with the then president-elect. But you know, they turned on him because of his behavior as president. Mm-hmm. And Trump, you know, viewed it as some sort of betrayal. So he just starts throwing mud, you know, right. At Scarborough, regardless of whether it was true or not.
So do you think, I mean, and this was something that actually came up in your last Skullduggery episode with ex-Congressman Riggle. I'm trying to remember his last name.
Yeah.
Denver Riggleman, yes. Oh, yeah, so he brought up, like, what is the responsibility of media platforms, social media platforms like Twitter, to regulate or to become better stewards of what's happening on their platform? Because when asked that question, I think the thing that did kind of shock me was that he was like, absolutely not First Amendment right.
Well, look, it is tricky. It's tricky. I mean, drawing lines is what's tricky. Look, we can all agree that QAnon crap is crap. And, you know,
yes.
If I'm running a social media platform, I don't want it on.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune into Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts, and remember, don't believe everything you read.
But, you know, I notice what Twitter does now on the election stuff, which is, by and large, crap. I mean, you know, but what they do is say, this account is disputed, right? Mm. Well, everything in politics is disputed, right? What's your standard? How are you deciding when you put that up there on somebody's tweets? Because, you know, one could take, you know, all sorts of comments every day by members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. And just as, you know, mm-hmm. depending on how passionate you are about the particular issue we're talking about, you know, you can say, well, at a minimum, that's disputed, right?
Right, or offensive. Like, offense is one thing and hate speech is sort of another.
Yeah. When you go after a person with personal attacks or demeaning personal attacks, you know, I think it's easier to draw the line there, although there could be, you know, gray areas. But when you get into political debates, I'm just not, the language that Twitter uses, this account of the election is disputed, mm-hmm. just seems to me to be either too lame,
a hedge,
or too much. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, saying something is disputed is sort of, it's the same problem. We often hear this from people, like we do, you know, when we do episodes on things like, say, climate change, and then we'll get comments from people in the audience asking, well, why didn't you have someone who denies climate change on? The argument I always give is they're not arguing in good faith. They don't have any, you know, mm-hmm. there's nothing for them to give me, right? That would be worth even you hearing. Yeah.
There's, you know, that is an issue at times, you know,
right.
But on the other hand, I am sort of, you know, I do resist conformity
and yeah, absolutely
just being dictated to about what I should believe or not believe. I want to be able to explore the evidence myself and reach my own conclusions about issues of debate. And on climate change, look, I don't think there's any serious debate about the existence of climate change, that our climate has been changing. It does strike me that there is legitimate, that there's no question that human, you know, carbon emissions have contributed to that and may in fact be the primary driver of it. But there is debate about, to what extent. And are we 2 or 3 years away from apocalypse, or are we 10 or 20 years? And that makes a difference when you're trying to come up with policies that might impact people's lives, right? You know, or so anyway, I don't like, well, I certainly believe in climate change. I certainly believe man-made, it's primarily man-made. I don't like shutting down debates about this by just sort of calling people denialists and refusing to hear what they have to say. There may in fact be some people who are trying to argue in good faith about aspects of this.
Oh, the, you know, and don't get me wrong, right? There absolutely are. I mean, that's one thing that we try really hard to do. And we're kind of one of the reason the show was even created in the first place was because there wasn't, we felt, enough content like this where you take seriously the arguments of people who believe in conspiracies or things that are out there on the fringe and then kind of pick them apart and see, does this actually make sense? Like, is it logically mm-hmm. consistent on its own? And then what effect does it have to the world around everything else? But I think that's part of the challenge, at least, is people don't really seem to be trained to do that kind of hard thinking. And at the same time as well, it's not, it's terrible.
You know, yeah, you I mean, it's confirmation bias. You want things, but you want things that reinforce your own worldview. That's sort of how I think how people are preset, right? Like I want something that's going to validate and make me feel good about my own decisions. That's why I want a conspiracy theory, right? Because then all of a sudden, not only is it explained sort of for me and it fits my worldview, but I'm in the know and I've gained some power from it or some autonomy or some agency.
Right.
Right.
But we do it.
So going against that is I think is not necessarily where people like how people are wired to do, which kind of like leads me to like the question of, so you've got something like QAnon, you have them now actually even being elected to office in certain states, which is amazing. So there's traction to it. How do you begin to, or does QAnon now just sort of maybe lose some steam now that Trump is coming out of office, or how do you begin to diffuse that?
they could gain steam with Biden in office, and you know all these deep state conspirators, returning to high level positions in the government.
That's the thing I don't get about QAnon is that, like, again, conspiracy theories are sort of thought of as, like, again, the disenfranchised. Like, I am looking at and making assumptions about people in power. And really, QAnon was about, and even sponsored by Donald Trump, inadvertently or inadvertently, and he was in power. It was about, like, the power structure he was in. So that's where I'm sort of like, that's even a weirder twist on it.
Well, but that's the thing, though. It's built on this sort of long, I think in the United States especially, we've had this very uncomfortable feeling about our military, about industry, about kind of the military industrial complex, quote unquote. And I think, honestly, QAnon, you know, a lot of people, when they mention the roots of QAnon, I actually think one area they miss is the history of the history of UFO conspiracy theories, actually, right? QAnon fits very nicely and snugly in with the idea that there is a cabal of ascended government officials who have alien technology, right? Like that idea has been percolating since the 1980s and gained steam in the 90s with coverage of people like Bob Lazar and these other sort of figures that came out and said, you know, we have secret spaceships in Area 51 and whatever. And then QAnon comes out and the public has already sort of been primed to believe that although there is the civilian government, there might be a secret government with the real answers. Right. Keeping a
secret alien government.
Exactly. Yes. Right. It's not a far leap. And so, you know, in my mind, it's why it's so important to nip the arguments in the bud before they happen. Like, I'll never forget. I was
then although you're hampering their free speech.
Well, okay. So although I disagree, I disagree drastically with Alex Jones, right? Like, we make fun of him mercilessly. We make fun of him mercilessly. Oh, right. Michael, this is the part of the show where we start talking about the real truth about the reptiles. I disagree. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. I disagree with Alex Jones and almost, you know, everything, every single thing about him. Right. But I listen to him, or I used to listen to him, especially every day before we started the show, because I wanted to know what was out there. What were these ideas out there? And I'll never forget, I was walking, and the beginning of the show, he goes, "We got a special guest today. We're going to be interviewing Donald Trump." And my brain exploded. You know, like, are you kidding me? Yeah. And now he's the president. Like, it's so important to take these things seriously before they get steam. Because once they have steam, it seems like it's an impossible task to stop them.
But I'm sorry, we actually cut you off, Michael. Please, I mean, we were talking about that QAnon
You know, the Alex Jones thing is, you know, that's really sad. And you're right, Trump went on his show, and, you know, he's such a despicable character. I mean, what he
yes.
did, and, you but know, like his Sandy said. Hook families and all that is just. You know,
absolutely.
Really shameful. But look, I mean, you know, Trump went on. I mean, Roger Stone was a regular on InfoWars, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, he was like, you know, Trump's longtime political advisor. So, you know, you have this conspiratorial mindset that was quite prevalent in Trump world. But, you know, back to your question about what happens after Trump leaves office, I would think that this isn't going to go away, mm-hmm. that whether it's the QAnon people per se or people who think like that are going to be more entrenched, angrier, because we're going to have a Democratic administration and power in Washington, and they'll have more things to be resentful and complain about and view through a conspiratorial lens.
Mm-hmm. So one of my questions that, you know, that I wanted to pose to you is, do you think, as an investigative journalist, do you think you'll ever find out who Q was? And does it matter? Does it, if you find out, disclose and put out, that's in the next conspiracy land. That's season three.
Does it matter? I don't know. I mean, who's this guy, Hawkins or Dawkins or
the head of, or the owner of 8chan, mm-hmm. right? Is that right? Or 8kun mm-hmm. or one of those sites?
One of the chans.
You may be more up to speed on this than I am, but I mean, do we think that guy is Q or,
I just really hope that at the end of all of this, the you know, QAnon posts on 4chan a screenshot and it's just a picture of Ivanka Trump smiling at her phone. You know what I mean? Like, the frustrating thing is that, especially if you kind of go back into the history of these message mm-hmm. boards and the stories that percolate, you know, the stories that exist on them, there have been people that supposedly came out and said these sorts of things for years. This is just the first one that came, you know, that really got any kind of traction. I think the next closest one to the Q character is probably that crazy guy who claimed he was from the future. What was his name? He posted a picture of him with a MacBook, and he was like, "This is my spaceship." You know, like, it was crazy. So I don't know. I mean, do I think that he is the person? I think that the most sensible argument I've ever seen for what QAnon is, and Marie, maybe you have another opinion on this than I do, mm-hmm. but the most interesting one I've ever seen was it's basically just a prank that has taken up legs and really gotten steam in a way that it doesn't matter anymore who was controlling it in the beginning, because now it's clearly being used to spread it's really a viral message, right? It's like those Facebook pages that, you know, initially they're a Facebook page about birdwatching or whatever, and then they get a million people in the group, and then they get sold to some, you know, some company that's hawking fake sunglasses, right? It seems to me to be the same kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, the part of me wants to find out who it, like, somebody's making an awful lot of money off of it. So I think that, you know, following the money yeah, on it would be good.
Somebody is making money on this.
Somebody's making a lot and is going to your point, continue to make a lot. So who's benefiting from that and finding out that? But then, you know, the other part of me is like, well, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. Like if you found out it's season three and it's 100% accurate, I don't think it's going to affect the following one iota. Like, I think that's almost irrelevant, that if Q is a real person or is a fake person, to Chris's point, it's already a virus, right? It's already too late. In fact, if anything, it's just going to reinforce the fact of the myth even more.
Well, they also just watch these freshman members of Congress, what's her name, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia,
who
you know, seems to be QAnon friendly. To have somebody like that sort of making speeches and on the floor of the House and sitting in a committee meetings and asking wackadoodle questions, I think that could only give prominence to it. You know, back to the historical roots of it, you know, she represents the same district as a congressman by the name of Larry McDonald in the 1970s and 80s. Larry McDonald was the chairman of the John Birch Society. He succeeded the Robert Welch, the candy manufacturer who accused Eisenhower of being a communist. And he was a total conspiracy theorist. We did a episode of Skullduggery on him and Conspiracy Land actually about a month or so ago. Rabid anti-communist, but more than that, you know, the deep state, there was, he saw, conspiracies left and right. And ultimately he dies. Remember when the Soviets shot down that, Korean airliner, in the 1980s, he was on it. And of course his followers saw that. So that the Soviets were going after the number one anti-communist in the country, Larry McDonald.
See, everything's connected, right? In conspiracy.
Everything is connected. And his, you know, heir is Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon congressman from the same part of Georgia.
I wonder if
sort of fitting. That's sort of nice, actually.
It's not
sort of reassuring in a weird way. What's sort of reassuring? It's like, oh, okay. There's been precedent for kook in that sort
of. Well, I do wonder, though, because this is something actually we on this show, I mean, we were telling you before that, you know, we try to engage with communities that believe in sort of, you know, non-traditional topics, I guess you'd say. And one question that often gets brought up to us when we do talks on this is, you know, do you think that, you know, if we find Bigfoot, right, or if we find an alien, or if we find the Loch Ness Monster, or any of these other things, do you think it would really change the conspiracy theory or the sort of some of these groups' mindsets, right? So I wonder if QAnon is sort of hitting the same problem, and in a less serious way, I guess it's the same problem that a lot of, you know, still traumatized by Game of Thrones, for example. You know, it's the same problem, right? How do you land the ship? You have this thing going for so long, and now you need to kind of close it off in a way that is sensible to people. And, you know, I think it doesn't matter if QAnon came out and said they were part of the government, or it came out and it was just this guy who owns this, you know, crazy message board making stuff up. There would still be, because the conspiracy theory never changes, it just changes the window dressing. It just changes forms. You know, that argument, that group of people who believe it, they would just change their views to meet the needs of the moment, right? It doesn't matter what QAnon is. The idea of QAnon, the kind of driving force, still remains. So the truth of it doesn't matter anymore.
And in some ways, you know, what we've done to combat it could end up exacerbating the
problem. Exactly.
Because, you know, as Twitter and Facebook and Instagram kick these folks off, you know, they migrate to even further fringe platforms, Parler, BitChute, what have you. And you and I don't even look at those. So we don't even know. We won't even know what they're talking about, right? At least on Twitter, you would see it because, you know, we're all on Twitter, we're all on Facebook, you know. But when you migrate to these completely fringe, you know, platforms, most people aren't going to be looking, and yet they'll still be talking to themselves. Now, will it be called QAnon? Will it be the exact same, you know, framework? Who knows? But certainly the mindset isn't going to go away.
Right. Mm. Well, you know, it's been 50 fascinating minutes so far.
Yeah.
Go, Marie.
Can you tell us? Can you tell us anything about season 3? Conspiracy Land? Any clues, any hints?
I would, but then I'd have to kill you. Oh. You know, I mean, like.
Oh.
There's one that's been in the works for some time. It's been delayed for a bit, COVID related. Stay tuned is all I can tell
you. All right.
Sounds good.
All right.
Yes.
Well, Michael Isikoff, thank you again so much. Yes. It was really such a pleasure. We would love to have you on again anytime. Anytime you need, I don't know, weird info from Chris and Marie, please do reach out. We're more than happy to help. And listeners, thank you again so much for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. We will be back next week with another episode. Please go listen to the Skullduggery Podcast. Go listen to Conspiracy Land. Follow Michael Isikoff on Twitter and follow the reporting. It's been some fascinating stuff. If you love the topics that we cover on the show, you really are going to want to follow Michael's work. So thank you again so much.
Yes, sure, anytime. It was fun conversation.
Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at madscientistpod or at teamgiantsquid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard.
Woohoo!
And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.